Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
This is The Author's Voice, new fiction from The New Yorker. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. On this episode of The Author's Voice, we'll hear Michael Andreessen read his story, The King's Teacup at Rest, from the July 11th, 2016 issue of the magazine. Andreessen has published fiction in Zoetrope All-Story and elsewhere. This is his first story in The New Yorker. Now here's Michael Andreessen.
The King's Teacup at Rest. Signed, notarized, everything in order. The royal steward returns the amusement park's deed to his crocodile leather attaché case and addresses the king. "Your Majesty," he says, in his most officious tone, extending a withered hand in the direction of the failing iron gates, "may I present, for your consideration, Liebling's Sunday Morning Carnival and Midway." His Royal Highness, the King of Retired Amusements, surveys the carnival grimly. Beside him, his modest cortege. The steward, tall and lengthily wrapped in a livery of black velvet, a powdered wig on his head and lace pursed at his collar and wrists, his spectacles at high perch. The scout, not yet 16, pale and freckled in his olive sash and khaki shorts. And the dancing bear, in a comically small fez and a Jacobean ruff, precariously balanced on a confetti-speckled ball, an atlas in reverse, his fabulously razored claws never deigning to touch the ground. "Not much," the king says. "It is autumn, and the air is beginning to turn. Your Majesty wishes to forego the inspection." "Are you sure you've brought us to the right place?" the king asks the scout. The boy looks at the tracks leading to the turnstiles, fingers the hand-carved eagle slider holding his neckerchief in place. The braided lanyards on his belt twiddle in the wind. He is quiet. The dancing bear yawns. "It is the usual pageant." The king scoffs. The steward humors. The king doubts. The scout is silent. The bear yawns. The steward prods. The king consents. "Shall we, sire?" "If we must," the king says. "Find refreshment quickly. We are hungry." The padlock and the chains undone. The gates wide. The whole of the park laid bare. The King of Retired Amusements shuffles across the threshold into his dominion. They are strange places, these abandoned fairgrounds and shipwrecked boardwalks and dry, cavernous water parks. Something more than people has deserted them, made the world turn its gaze elsewhere and not look back. Often they are barren craters, worn and ruined beyond remembering. But Liebling's Sunday Morning Carnival in Midway is another Pompeii, as preserved and perfect as a fly in amber. The Ferris wheel, still fully erect, regards the party like a cold and distant sun, its carriages creaking in a shovel of wind. Flags still flag on their poles, and bunting still hangs from the ticket booths. Only the main courtyard shows signs of dereliction. The statue at its center, a bronze, top-headed Gustav Liebling himself, has been toppled, his magnanimity run aground, his outstretched arms now bidding welcome only to a patch of broken flagstones and soft dirt, which, after a few more good rains, will surely swallow him whole. The king turns to the bear, now lying horizontal on his ball, teetering, asleep. He plucks the fez from the animal's head and flogs him with it until, With a prolonged stretch that seems to solidify the bear's balance rather than upset it, he rises. "Hot dogs," the king says. The beast lifts his nose to the high wind and inhales. In the courtyard, fallen leaves rustle nearer. Slowly, he adjusts his heading and rolls the ball in the direction of the midway, and the men follow. The hot dog stand. A few bloated green wieners still floating in a steel pond of brine. Fungal buns spill out of the trolley's lower compartment. Pigeons have been at them. A few are still lying in dizzy, half-dead piles nearby. The smell of the cart has made the bear morose. "Forgive me, sire," the steward says, "but these look unfit for your majesty's consumption." "We will eat them," the king declares. "Relish?" "Also unwise," the steward says. "Just a dab, then." "Please, sire," the steward entreats, "recall the fish tacos at the Morriston County Fair." He looks to the scout for help. The boy says nothing, pretending instead to read a smear of pigeon droppings on the cotton candy machine. "Serve and obey," the king says. The steward bows. With a handkerchief over his nose, he constructs something that, in a world without proper standards, could be considered a hot dog. He serves it to the king on a small silver platter drawn from his attaché case. The king stuffs the mass into his face, rancid mustard peeling down his chin and onto the mange of his ermine. "Passable," the king declares. "Now take us to the rides." The steward bows again and gestures toward a distant banner that reads, "Cul-de-sac of Fun." "We suppose you'll be disappearing again," the king says to the scout. The boy lifts his eyes from the pigeon poop. "I must find my people," he says. "Very well," the king sighs. "Be ready to lead us back in an hour." He repositions his threadbare cape against the breeze. The air is chilly. Already his stomach is expressing misgivings about the hot dog. The less time spent here, he decides, the better. The midway. A shoot of empty booths, still bright, with new paint. The scout reads the trampled popcorn boxes, the displaced gravel, the wailing wind. They tell of a fleeing multitude, a people retreating in panic, his kin on the run. A balloon dartboard abandoned in haste. Sawdust-stuffed neon orange rabbits left to molt. But no pursuer that he can find. No advancing army's boot prints. No claw marks the length of a man raked jaggedly across the ring toss booth. The bear rolls quietly beside the scout, sniffing the air. "They have quit this place, John Bennington," he says. "I have not finished looking," the boy replies, "but it's a lie. Any tracker could see that no human feet have touched this ground in months." "I said that you would not find them here," the bear reminds him. "They are like the hungry, wild spirits of old. This land is chewed and spat out again. You cannot expect them to tarry." "Be silent," the scout says. "Let me think." "Thinking will not change the direction of the wind," the bear says, adjusting his fez with a graceful claw. "You cannot bid the wolf to stop its baying, nor the whippoorwill to postpone its dirge. You cannot bid your people stay." "I do not know my people," the scout says. "I do not know what I might bid them do." The boy has never met his people. Indeed, he did not know he had a people until he met the dancing bear. The boardwalk at Gavin's Point, where the orphaned scout had made a meager living selling saltwater taffy and guessing weights, had reached its economic nadir. The drug cartel Los Compasivos controlled a majority interest in the boardwalk and its environs. And, while a shakedown of the boy's booth was rare, the smack addicts left in the cartel's wake made for a poor clientele. Malodorous and malnourished, they would make the boy guess their pathetically low weights to guilt him out of free taffy and sack lunches. It was only after the king of retired amusements arrived to take final ownership of the boardwalk that the boy was acquainted with the details of his lineage. As the king and the steward parleyed with Los Compasivos, The boy heard the whisper-thin voice of the dancing bear, speaking only to him. "I know who you are, John Bennington," the bear had said. "And I know what you must do to fill the hole inside you that wails like a hollow tree and knows no quiet. Before there were ringmasters and zookeepers, before men baited bears and made them roll, we taught your people the ways of the wilderness. Now they have become relentless seekers of delectation and distraction. They once walked this boardwalk, eating shaved ice and posing for selfies, but fled at the first sign of commercial depreciation, abandoning it all to indulgence and petty crime, and, at last, to the king of retired amusements. And in their great haste, they left you behind. Follow me, the bear said, and I will show you how to find them again." By the time the steward had returned his spent Mac-10 to his crocodile attaché, the boy was on bended knee, offering his service and allegiance to the king. The bear taught him to scout. The boy learned how to dress wounds, remove ticks, and handle scat without fear. With this tutelage came recognitions of merit, badges for woodcraft, campsite cleanliness, bravery, animal friendship. But most important, the bear taught him orienteering, not by reading maps or stars, but by following the compass of his own loneliness. The boy learned how to direct his senses away from ease and contentment, to turn his needle instead to where others had turned their backs. There, he was told, he would find his people, refugees fleeing the squalor of the boardwalk, who left behind gutted big tops and disrepaired carousels, vacant outdoor malls and imitation colonial townships littered with broken, historically inaccurate tools. The scout could mark and follow the trail his people left with ease, but only ever seemed to arrive after they had gone. Here again, at Liebling's Sunday morning carnival in Midway, he has arrived too late. "You will search but not find," the bear says, assuming the lotus position atop his ball, which has suddenly turned the color of the night sky, alive with blazing comets and galactic spirals. Small birds come to perch on the bear's ears and shoulders. The air becomes thick with a foggy radiance. Around him, the limpid aura of unimpeachable knowledge. Above him, the halo of oneness with all things. "You will walk the unmanicured path, the path of sorrow upon sorrow." "You say that every time," the scout replies. The tracks of his people lead beyond the carnival into a dense wilderness of gray birch and red cedar. "Come," the bear says, gesturing back toward the midway. "I have something to show you." Deep in the cul-de-sac of fun, the Viking ship. The king of retired amusements aboard, seated, displeased. The steward frowning at the controls, pulling the lever fruitlessly, fingering buttons with little confidence. He has dreaded this moment since the night Rudy Vermiglia, the royal engineer, absconded with the queen. In between consoling the inconsolable king in the starlit parking lot of the La Quinta Inn and coaxing him onto his feet and back into the motel room before his cries of cuckolded anguish drew the attention of the other guests, the steward had envisioned with great trepidation this precise scenario. Machines had a history of disobedience in his presence, and the scout could barely be counted on to stay within shouting distance, let alone to troubleshoot technical difficulties. And so now, here in the terrible present, the steward stands engineerless, brow creased, hands slick with perspiration, his lord and employer seated in the mock longship, perilously unamused. "We wish to feel the rock of the waves," the king says, impatience agitating a stomach already on the verge of sedition. "To know the kiss of the wind. We wish to command the horizon, to see it bow and rise before us, as is our sovereign right." The flag atop the faux mast crispens in salute. The faux rigging is at the ready. "What," the king inquires, "is the goddamn holdup?" "I beg your indulgence, Majesty," the steward says. "The device is uncooperative." He reaches into his attaché case and consults the diagnostic checklist that accompanied Rudy Vermiglia's letter of resignation. Is there power running to the mechanism? The checklist asks. The light is on, so yes, one would assume, power is being received. Are any of the lights red or green? The illuminated light is yellow, which suggests little by way of either readiness or lack of readiness. Caution, it seems, is the message. But caution against what? The pulling of the lever? The steward has already pulled the lever several times, so his hope is, no, not that. The depressing of buttons? One of the red buttons has already been depressed, and has remained depressed. Are the safety systems engaged? Could this depressed red button represent the safety systems? If he pressed it again, would it undepress, thereby disengaging the safety systems? The steward presses the red button again. It does not undepress. The light does not change. It is still yellow, the color of abeyance, unease, hesitation. Is there a hard lock? And if so, has the proper key been inserted and turned, releasing the lock? In an interior panel, nestled under a muscle of wire, obscured by a misinstalled switch cover, a secret hidden behind secrets, small, unassuming, bashful in the sunlight, a hard lock. A soul might look for hours and still miss it. Digging into the pocket of his velvet coat for his key ring, the steward wonders how many small answers like this he has missed over the years. Discrete solutions to life's puzzles that can be found only by those who know precisely what to look for. He wonders, was this ride, maybe even this entire carnival, abandoned simply because someone could not find the right metaphorical lock? And if he had discovered a different metaphorical lock years ago, and fitted it with the correct metaphorical key, would he be standing here now, on this gray autumn day, in this livery, serving this king? The steward inserts and rotates the appropriate key, releasing the lock. The machine howls to life. The yellow light turns green, indicating satisfaction, announcing readiness, recognizing authority, command. Control. The steward pulls the lever, and at once the Viking ship is pendulous. The king, however, has been rocking for a while. He is the victim of food poisoning. His skin is pallid. He sweats. As the ship's arc widens, the king is made to feel the physical force of today's mistake, followed quickly by the psychic force of a lifetime of human error. His gaffes, his royal miscalculations. As sky and earth swap seats, he is visited again by his catastrophic failures. The purchase of Humboldt's puppet theater in Barksdale, for example. The decision to walk the 10 miles to Greavesport, Michigan, in January, without properly insulated footwear. The hot dog. The queen left alone with Rudy Vermiglia while he inspected Gizmo's giant go-getter. These regrets float above him now in the faux rigging, unaffected by the cuisinarting of the world. They mock and assail him, call him a disgrace, a punchline, a pretender king. It was in moments like this, when his guts were in tumult and his brain felt unmoored from his body, that the queen would take his head in her lap and say to him, quiet now, just quiet. Would whisper to him, just shut up. Would say to him, you're shit-faced. Or, you smell like total ass. Or, Jesus Christ, when will you learn? And her fingers, soft as daffodils, would set aside his crown and twist tufts of his sideburns into knots and pull the hairs of his ears from their tender follicles until, red and swollen, he slid into dreamless sleep. And later, when he woke and left their hotel room to survey a new park or arcade, she would say, bring back cigarettes. Bring back cigarettes. Her eyes lost in contemplation of the television. Her fingers delicately balancing a butt above the ashtray, or the Bible, or the cigarette-burned silk of her slip. Bring back cigarettes, with the distraction of a goddess. Bring back cigarettes. And he would marvel that words so holy had ever been uttered. He brought back cartons. He showered her with menthols and ultralights, filtered and unfiltered. And, for a time, they were happy. The Funhouse, animatronic vampires and ghouls, the rattling of chains, or perhaps just a recording of it. The moaning is almost certainly on a loop. The jolting screams are too earnest to be real. The scout has been led by his animal guide through the maze of mirrors to a room made to look like a graveyard. Their entrance triggers a sensor that activates the smoke machine. The bear stands upright on his ball, which now glows a night-like green, filled with what appears to be a swarm of fireflies. With a giant paw, he swipes at the rubber bats dangling from the ceiling. Though they are indoors, there are trees, grass. The tombstones are styrofoam. The skeletons glow in the dark plastic cast. Hovering above an open grave with an exposed casket is the incorporeal spirit of one of the scout's ancestors. "Hail, John Bennington, son of Bryce and Courtney, who walks the unmanicured path," the ancestral spirit says. "And to you, sage of boyhoods, who rules the world beneath him." The spirit wears an opalescent white golf shirt over tan chinos. A salmon-pink cardigan rests on its shoulders like a mantle. Its spectral hair is handsomely thinned, and its sockless, loafered feet hover just above the floor. At the lip of the open grave, the ghost of a Pekingese lies napping. The dancing bear yawns grandly, maneuvering on the ball until he is flat on his belly. "Hail, Great Spirit," he says. "Our meeting is fortunate, for John Bennington has many questions to ask regarding the ways of his people." "Then he shall ask them," the ancestral spirit says, "and be answered." But the scout says nothing. Hearing the spirit speak the names of parents he has never known has caught him off guard. For a moment, there is only the sound of recorded moaning and the leaky tire hiss of the smoke machine. The ancestral spirit clears its throat. The bear is irritated. The dreaming Pekingese rolls over on its back and bicycles the air with its paws. "For example," the bear interjects, "John Bennington may wish to learn the wisdom of the Homeowners Association. Tell him how a strict observance of yard waste disposal guidelines helps to maintain harmony with nature." "And property values," the ancestral spirit says. "That too," the bear says. "No," the scout says, finally finding his voice. "Tell me why my people left me at the Gavin's Point boardwalk to guess the weights of drug addicts." The ancestral spirit looks momentarily cowed. It pretends to be distracted by an email on its cell phone. "Are you sure you would not rather ask another question?" the spirit asks. "About your place in this world, perhaps. Have you no wish to access the volumes of cultural insight bequeathed to you by your people?" "Tell him the parable of the independent subcontractor and the hornet's nest," the bear says. "Yes," the spirit says, "that's a good one." "No," the scout repeats. "Why was I abandoned?" The Pekingese suddenly stirs. This exchange is unexpected and worth being awake for. "It is not your people's way to ask such direct questions of their ancestors, John Bennington," the bear says. "It makes them uncomfortable." "I do not know our ways," the scout says. "That is why I am here," the ancestral spirit says. "Why do they flee?" the scout asks. "Are they in danger?" "Ours is a story of constant discomfort, of annoyance that knows no end," the spirit proclaims in a voice meant to carry over the crackle of backyard terracotta fire pits and the chewing of caprese salad skewers. "Dilapidation makes us uneasy," the spirit explains, "and passé architecture offends us. We search for new, exclusive, and ergonomically designed playgrounds as one might look for a sun that has already set, a moon that is always new. For no place is ever truly ours and ours alone, to lounge in as we please, in safety and in peace." "What the hell does that mean?" the scout wants to know. But he knows. "You must not ask in this way," the ancestral spirit says. The Pekingese has returned to its nap. The bear is also asleep, snoring hard into the green glow of his ball. The artificial smoke hangs low in the room. It smells sterile and chemical. It is nothing like real smoke, heavy with vaporized sap and hot with embers. When the boy departs, it will not cling to his clothes and linger in his hair. "Screw it," the scout says. He leaves the room, its skeletons and its ghosts. He leaves the bear asleep on his ball. A mannequin, dressed like a menacing clown, knife points the way to the exit. The boy does not startle as the fake guillotine blade falls inches from his heels. He escapes the imaginary perils of the funhouse intact. But outside, with the sun mostly gone and the day growing colder, he is not sure which direction to take. His compass is attuned only to absence, to abandonment. Outside the funhouse, the needle inside him pirouettes, unable to locate any place more lonesome than the ground upon which he stands. Full tilt. The good earth perpendicular, then parallel, then perpendicular. A universe upside down. Vomit on the royal ermine. The Viking ship is a swing possessed, a cradle gone mad. This, the king knows, is what comes from trusting engineers. This is the fruit of their handiwork. "God in heaven," he proclaims between barfs, "deliver us from this evil." The steward returns the level to its first position. The arc of the ship acutes. The king of retired amusement collapses onto the boarding platform and dry heaves through the grate. "Perhaps a respite," the steward says. "You are sent from hell to destroy me," the king says. The steward offers his sovereign a handkerchief and, with great deference, hoists him onto his feet. "There is a bench," he says. "Unsuitable," the king replies. He points to a nearby attraction. "There." "Your Majesty, I must protest. Not to ride," the king says, the handkerchief over his mouth, in case, just to sit. The teacups. Minus waltz and whimsy, minus passengers, save the king, who growls and retches against the pastel floor of the ride, and the steward, who apologizes ardently, but only to a point. When the hot dog is mentioned, he says nothing. When the engineer is mentioned, he says nothing. When the queen is mentioned, he readies another handkerchief. It is not his fault, nor the king's fault, nor the engineer's. It is a world in constant motion. Even here, in the stillness of the teacup, its shifting is too wild and too unpredictable for any to move safely within it. The dancing bear rolls up to the ride. His ruff has the crumpled look of having been slept on. His fez hangs low on his brow. Every few minutes, he sniffs the air, redirects his muzzle, sniffs again, whimpers. "Is that the boy?" the king asks from the floor of his teacup. "No, sire," the steward says. "The animal." "That little twerp had better show up soon," the king says, "or he can stay lost." But the threat is a hollow one. The king of retired amusements, lord of salvage and recoup, is not in the business of leaving things behind. He will not lose another member of the cortege if he can help it. And when he can no longer help it, when it becomes clear that the scout will not return, and the bear will not stop grieving, and the steward will not survive another winter with his fealty intact, he will press on alone. Absent cape and crown and royal retinue, he will wander the earth in search of those joyless cavities still crying out for their king. The steward gathers his velvet coat around him and scans the area for proper shelter. He knows they will not make it back to the motel by nightfall. They will go to sleep hungry on the floor of the Independence Day gazebo in the middle of the all-holiday promenade. That night, the steward will wake to the sound of weeping. He will reach for his last unsoiled handkerchief before realizing that it is not the king, but the bear atop his ball, sobbing in his sleep. The sound will be great and low, like the crying of a mountain. And into that sound, the steward will smuggle his own small grief, his own ruings and regrets, which he knows have no place in a world of such delight.
That was Michael Andreessen reading his story, The King's Teacup at Rest. He lives in Southern California, where he's finishing his first collection of stories. You can hear more New Yorker fiction read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker apps available from the App Store or from Google Play. On the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, we invite writers to choose stories from the magazine's archives to read and discuss. This month, Ben Lerner reads Woven, Sir by John Berger. You can subscribe to that and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available on iTunes or Audible.com. Tell us what you thought of this podcast by rating and reviewing The Author's Voice on iTunes. Our theme music is by Jordan Batiste and Ross Michaels of North American Plastics. The Author's Voice is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.